I mean, why do people stay? We didn't have a good way of understanding it. And it had gone along, and people moved away from looking at duration. They would plug it into a model, and it would say, you know, the longer you've stayed, the more likely you are to stay. But how, that doesn't explain it, does it?
This is Parsing Science, the unpublished stories behind the world's most compelling science, as told by the researchers themselves. I'm Ryan Watkins.
And I'm Doug Lay. There might be no place like home, but as Dorothy discovered in The Wizard of Oz, where one's house lies matters quite a bit. Today, Ryan and I talk with Bill Clark from UCLA's Department of Geography, who discusses his research into how deciding to move from one's home or to stay put isn't necessarily the rational process that most of us think that it is.
This episode is sponsored by We Share Science. When researchers are curious about what is happening in science, they go to We Share Science to explore video abstracts uploaded by other researchers. You can search their vast catalog of video abstracts to learn about the latest scientific findings, or you can share your research with the world. Whether your research is in progress or already published, at We Share Science, you can share your science and grow your impact. Explore the world's research at wesharescience.org. Now, back to Parsing Science.
Here's Bill Clark.
Well, hi, I'm Bill Clark. Because it was Clark and it's a common name, I always used all my initials. I'm William Arthur Valentine Clark. I grew up in New Zealand, and it was a very different kind of time and place. There is a joke for a long time about when people arrived in New Zealand. They said, well, you've arrived in New Zealand. The local time is X. Set your clock back 20 years. There was a sense that New Zealand had been somewhat isolated or left behind. Certainly, when I was a student there, you waited for a long time to get the journals because, of course, there was no internet. There were no computers, in effect. And so everything was by mail. And so you got the science journals months after they'd been published in the Northern Hemisphere. But I grew up through a education system that was very standard, modeled on the British system, of course, and did my first 2 degrees in New Zealand. But like many New Zealanders, you long to see the rest of the world. You're down there thousands of miles away, and at that time, air travel was very expensive, so you went by boat. And I was lucky enough to get a Fulbright and came to the U.S. to do a PhD at the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana. I was interested in quantitative geography. I was interested in how we could bring science to bear on some of the geographical questions, because geography had been very much focused on what was called regional differentiation. People talked about how areas were different. But I thought we could do more by looking at cities and trying to understand how they worked. And it was a very exciting time. There was a lot going on in terms of new work in quantitative work in geography. It was before geographical information systems really got going, GIS, but there were a lot of geographers interested in how could we bring quantitative methods to bear on geographic problems.
Trained as a geographer, the notion of place has always been central to Bill's research. Doug and I wondered what interested him in pursuing geography as a profession to begin with.
Well, geography is strong in New Zealand, in the British tradition. I often joke if it was stronger in this country, we wouldn't have the Afghanistan problem. People would understand more. But I was always interested in maps, and I think you've talked to a lot of geographers. They start out being interested in maps and distance and place. And then they realize that, wait a minute, geography is more than naming the capitals of the states of the United States or the whatever county towns. It's really about understanding relationships. And we're always interested in place. Where you live, where you go to school, there's a big debate about how much the place itself matters as distinct from the people in the place. That's an ongoing discussion about what are called neighborhood effects. But there's no question that cities, places, regions are differentiated. And a lot of the focus of my work was understanding segregation, understanding what I refer to as sorting and selection. You know, why do people live where they do? What are the choices they make? All the research I've done on Los Angeles, in fact, brings up these areas of trying to measure diversity and trying to measure change. So people and place, which is what we often talk about, are central in geography. They're central in our lives. And I think it was that sort of going from maps to thinking about how places are organized that attracted me into geography. But I realized we needed some tools to look at that, and that's how we bring in the statistical modeling.
Bill's research investigates questions of why people move and clearly recognizes that all moves are not equal. To clarify the distinctiveness of moves, Bill differentiates short-distance moves, or residential mobility, from longer-distance ones, referred to as migration.
People often use the term mobility. And of course, mobility has become a bit of a catchword, and now people are saying mobilities, referring to everything from commuting to going to the store. But when we talk about residential mobility and migration, or when we use the word migration, we're talking about, I'll use the word relatively permanent moves. That is, we can think of them all as migration. But when you move within the city, the general way we describe that is we call it residential mobility. You've changed houses. When you move from Irvine to Washington, you've migrated. And essentially the issue, of course, is distance. So a longer distance move is migration, a shorter distance move is residential mobility. So when you move from the west side to San Fernando Valley, as my son recently did, he's made a residential move. He changed houses. Now, you'll immediately think about a region like California, think about Los Angeles. If you move from L.A. to Orange County, have you made a residential move or have you migrated? This is when you get into the issues of how do you decide. But for people interested, residential mobility is changing houses, more or less. And migration is moving longer distances. It used to be for jobs, but increasingly now it's for a whole range of questions, from being near family, retirement moves. There's a whole range of things that induce migration.
Important life decisions, such as when and where to move, are commonly complex with multiple considerations involved. Given the many years he had studied these decisions, we were interested in hearing from Bill how he himself had decided where to move over time.
I mean, I've spent a lot of time studying why people move and where they move. That's been my fundamental research agenda and project, has been trying to understand residential mobility and migration and choice. And when I was searching for the house I live in now, where I've lived a long time, I had got remarried and I was going to acquire children, as my Swedish friends say, about getting stepchildren is you get bonus children. I'd never thought of them as that way, but it's a lovely term. And we were going to have a child. So we needed to move and get a house. And this is my area. This is my specialty. So I had maps and I had charts and I knew about search areas. Well, of course, it didn't work out that way. We live in a house that we saw at the end of my search radius, which was in a total other area of the city. The real estate agent, why don't you look at this house? I said, no, it's outside the search area. And my wife wisely said, well, why don't we just stop at it? We're going to have lunch in that area anyway. So we stopped, and of course we bought it. But that said, it fulfilled all the criteria. It had enough rooms. It was in our price range. It was within walking distance of a school, et cetera, et cetera. In other words, it fulfilled a certain number of rational expectations, but at the margin, there were elements that were not completely rational. And I think that's what the behavioral economists are trying to tell us, that we work within an arena of decisions, and some of them are drawn from our experience, others are drawn from exterior impacts. But in the end, we're trying to to make decisions that are best for us. We don't always do that. They may be mostly good, but not perfect, as standard economics talk about, you know, equilibriums, and they don't always exist.
Beginning in the 1970s, Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky developed prospect theory as a challenge to the common belief that, on average, people make decisions rationally. Instead, they suggested that we tend to make decisions based on our prospects of avoiding the risk of unwanted losses against the probability of achieving desirable gains. Since then, their work has fueled advances in most every field of social science, as well as many natural science disciplines. Here, Bill describes how he came to employ Kahneman and Tversky's formulation of the endowment effect, the idea that people ascribe more value to things merely because they already own them, within his study.
The question when you're trying to look at the ideas in Kahneman and Tversky is that you're really focusing on the issues of risk, because that underpins a lot of the arguments that they make in prospect theory. And you're going to have a measure of risk. Well, most surveys don't ask people about risk-taking. They do ask about, will you take a financial risk? But that's somewhat different from asking a question about how risk-averse you are. So we took data from a survey of individuals in Australia. We looked at what they said their risk likelihood was, whether they were risk-averse or whether they were risk-takers. And we related that to whether or not they moved, whether they made a migration. In other words, arguing that if you're more of a risk-taker, you're more willing to take a risk and find a new job somewhere else. And to explain that risk-taking behavior, we broaden the notions of endowment, that whether or not you were attached to where you are. These are all questions, I think, that get at what I've been fascinated with, and that is how people decide where to live and how to adjust the other big decisions. I mean, if you think about it, there are the big decisions of who to be a partner with and where to locate with that partner. Those are the two big questions. And then, of course, there are all the questions about having a family, which then influence further whether you make a decision to move.
Disciplines can often benefit from research done in other domains. And just as others learn from geographers, geographers learn from others' research as well. Here, Bill summarizes his novel approach to applying prospect theory, which emerged in psychology and decision sciences, and later found mass appeal in behavioral economics, as a theoretical framework in his study of geography.
Because geography is eclectic, I've always argued with my grad students, they would say, well, I'm a population geographer, I study population. Why should I go and hear this guy talk about the problems of the encroaching deserts in the Sahel in Africa? And I say, well, you go there not necessarily just for the substance of the talk, but how is he presenting it, what's he saying, and how did he get to this place to talk about it? And you don't know that there won't be something that will trigger something in your mind that will help you think about your problem. And I've always made this argument that eclecticism, listening, going to a talk and listening to it, it's not necessary that you are fascinated by that topic, but that that topic may trigger things in your mind about what you're doing. So the contribution to me of the paper was to move away from looking at these studies that focused on movers or stayers and showed that we could explain duration, which has always been sort of a black box. We could explain it by invoking the ideas embedded in prospect theory, but that are essentially ideas about endowment. What I think we could do was provide a theoretical rationale for why duration matters in migration decisions. It's not duration per se, but it's duration as a proxy for endowment. And remember, endowment is the central contribution of prospect theory, and that's all about gains and losses. Gains and losses in terms of what a household already has. And of course, that's what you're doing when you make a migration decision. you're saying, am I going to move from Los Angeles to New York? What am I giving up? What am I gaining? And we can understand that in terms of prospect theory.
In the early 1970s, Peter Morrison of RAND Corporation, a nonprofit think tank, authored a paper that would later make a substantial influence on Bill's research. Here he explains how Morrison's work suddenly became very salient again when, 40 years later, its relevance to Kahneman's research to the duration that people choose to stay put in their homes became evident.
I did a lot of work on duration. I was really interested in who stays and why they stay. And what Peter had said, well, wait a minute, the demographers and geographers are saying there's two groups of people, those who stay and those who move. And we know that some people do move more often than others. There are frequent movers. But the literature went down this path of stayers and movers. And I, the more I thought about it, I thought, you know, Peter is right. He said it's a continuum. Sometimes you're moving, sometimes you're staying. But all the work I did on duration was sort of black box stuff. I mean, why do people stay? We didn't have a good way of understanding it. And it had gone along, and people moved away from looking at duration. They would plug it into a model, and it would say, you know, the longer you've stayed, the more likely you are to stay. But how, that doesn't explain it, does it? So when I was reading Kahneman's book, Thinking Fast and Slow, which we cite in the article, he has a little statement in there somewhere, and I can't recall it exactly, where he says, well, you know, whether people move or stay is related to housing. And it's sort of almost a throwaway line in Thinking Fast and Slow. But the more I'd looked at it, the more I thought, you know, this is really a way to think about the duration effect. And that's what led to the research. Because we're thinking, wait a minute, we can use Kahneman's ideas about the endowment effect as a theoretical explanation for duration, for staying. And that's what we did.
To examine risk-taking within the context of mobility and migration, Bill required a dataset that included measures of people's propensity for risk as well as their moving behaviors. He found both in Australia.
Now, someone looked at risk and migration using the German Socioeconomic Panel, GSOEP. They published a paper, some economists, saying that people who are more willing to take risks are more likely to migrate. And that was neat. It's a good paper. And that stimulated us to think about, well, but wait a minute. They didn't look at the demographic controls. They didn't worry about all those things that demographers worry about age and marital status and education and occupation. They just looked at risk. And so we thought, well, wait a minute, with the HILDA data, which is an Australian survey, an excellent survey, it covers lots of things. It's the Housing Income Labour Dynamics in Australia survey. And it's been going for about 15 years now. And they asked this question on risk. And so we were able to look at that and assign risk to individuals and then relate it to their mobility, to their migration behavior. And it's not a perfect explanation. I mean, yes, people who are risk averse are more likely to be stayers, and people who are more likely to take risks are more likely to move. But when you look at the graph, you see there's a lot of variability. In other words, people stay who are willing to take risks, but they stay. And that's where you get at trying to tease out what is causing that staying, what is causing that duration. And of course, one of the big things we know is that if you own a house, you're more likely to stay. You are invested in the community. So what we know is renters move more often than stayers. That's been well known for 30, 40 years. But we never had a good way of getting at that in a theoretical framework. We did a paper that's published in Demographic Research where we laid out the theory, where we took Kahneman's theory and laid it out for a study of housing. And this paper is a follow-up of that paper showing how we could actually test the model. So those two papers are a pair, and I'm hoping over the long run that they will get attention from the economists and from the demographers as a way of understanding migration and mobility. But as you know, it takes a while for things like this to pick up steam.
In developing prospect theory, Tversky and Kahneman researched how people make decisions with embedded risks. Here, Bill relates how his study sought to extend their work to housing decisions.
They did a number of analyses in, and they're reported in Thinking Fast and Slow, summaries of their papers. But they were using things like coffee cups and simple things that people, you know, if people were unwilling to give up the coffee cup they liked, even though they could buy one for much the same money. In other words, people invested more in something they liked. And so the endowment effect was that you endowed it with more value than it actually was worth. That was the notion underlying their ideas of the way in which the endowment effect worked. And so it was related to risk in that you were unwilling. If you look at, they have a very nice curve, which we published in the initial paper and which is in their book, that you value something you have more than you should. That's the basic in economic terms. You value it more. You're unwilling to give it up. And that leads to a point they make about housing. People often value their house at more than it actually would sell for. So they're attached to their house. They endow it with more than its monetary value. And so we can think about someone who says, well, my house is worth $1 million in California. But the real estate agent may say, no, actually, it probably really will sell for $900,000. And people are reluctant to let the house go for less than what they think it should get. So this is all built into this notion of the endowment. The idea is that endowment and the way you endow it is also related to the sort of risks you're willing to take. So it's the risk aversion and the endowment effect, which we show in the model, play a role in whether or not people will migrate.
Bill's research extends beyond the kinds of questions that geographers and demographers more typically explore by examining why people make decisions of when and where to move. In answering this question, he considered the length of time that people decided to stay put as a surrogate of the endowment effect, as he explains next.
Place attachment matters, that you're reluctant to give up what you have, because what you've done is you've formed attachment to people. You have doctors, you have dentists, you have financial advisors, you have the cadre of people that you interact with. Now, some of them you can do it long distance, but there's a sense of place attachment that emerges when you start asking people, why did you move? We ask people, why did you move? And there's an interesting divide. The economists never asked people why they moved. They did migration studies where they looked at what the wage rates were in place X, the wage rates in place Y, and then they formulated models that explained people moving from one place to another because they were responding to differences in wages, and the argument was that brought the system into equilibrium. Well, when you look at why people move, jobs aren't that, they're there, but they're not the critical, they're not what people say critically. And there's a bit of a division between the economists who want to write formal models about unemployment rates and geographers and demographers who want to say, well, it's a bit more complicated than that. It may, you need a job. But when we looked at some data, a lot of people moved and made less money, but they moved to be near family, they moved to be near friends. So, it's a more complicated story.
At the end of our conversation, Ryan and I asked Bill what exciting changes he anticipates are coming to the discipline of geography.
Well, certainly with the huge proliferation, the big data movement, which has got its pluses and minuses, has really changed the way people are approaching research. And there's an argument I'm sure that you've come across goes on about whether big data can really help us, whether we can do research without having hypotheses and theory, or whether we can just do data mining. And that's an argument that's going on a lot in GI science and in people doing GIS, geographical information systems. Because with the release of, for example, the census data, you can get now under restricted access to all 300 million observations in the census. That really changes how you think about how you do research, because you've got the whole population.
That was Bill Clark discussing his article, Prospect Theory and the Decision to Move or Stay, published with Bill Lisowski in the September 5th, 2017 edition of PNAS. You'll find a link to their paper on parsingscience.org, along with other materials that he discussed during the show.
If you've got a tip for Parsing Science, let us know that we should explore it. We'd love to hear from you, like we did from this caller.
Hi, this is Courtney. I'm calling from Utah. I was just calling to let you know I really enjoy your show, and I have a suggestion for your listeners. There's another podcast out there by Marie McNeely called People Behind the Science, and it's similar to yours, but it's nice to have a lot of different ideas about the same subject. So I suggest that your listeners and you, if you haven't already heard of her, give her a shot and see what you like about her podcast.
You can call us toll-free at 1-844-XPLORIT. That's 1-844-975-6748. Leave us a message, and we might feature your call in a future show.
Next time on Parsing Science, we'll be joined by Nikki Den Neuenboer from the University of Kansas School of Business. She'll talk with us about her research into how middle managers commonly corrupt business directives by intentionally misrepresenting them to employees.
That was a cocktail that was toxic enough for the middle managers to decide, you know, it's not going to work in an ethical way, and so we're going to make it work in an unethical way.
We hope that you'll join us again.